In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. If you go and travel with Bedouin tribes, those nomadic peoples that wander the deserts of Arabia, you will find a startling practice among mothers of newborns. They will wash their children in camel urine, if not their own. Now, if my three children were here this morning, they would say, "Could we do that?" And I would say, "No, it's out of the question, because your mother has only preserved about a third of a gallon. It won't be enough." That one's for you, honey. It's also the case that in other nomadic peoples, they knew instinctually that if you ever got an axe wound, the best thing to treat it would be with moldy bread. They got it before what's-his-name who came up with penicillin ever thought of it. They knew it. And in a very different setting, the story is told of a gypsy woman who was in the business of restoring instruments, even violins. And in that story, it was told that every night after she had completed that day's effort to bring restoration to that violin, she would wrap it in a cloth. And that cloth would be coated in a very fine dust, a dust that was dried, desiccated, sieved horse manure. That there was some property in that dust that would add to the restorative process for an instrument, that which would not play might someday resound with new life. Now, where am I getting these stories from? Yeah. There is a Canadian author, I'm told, by the name of Benjamin Davies, who writes novels about all of these true facts, about people who use that which was discarded to bring forth new life. And the only reason I know about this Canadian author is because Alan Jacobs wrote an essay I read a few weeks ago that's going to eventually end up in his book that's coming out later this year about how to think. And he would say that you and I have something to learn from all of those examples when it comes to learning about truth, that you and I need to look under every nook and cranny and even take those things that most other people would discard out of hand because there is something to be found in it. And so Alan Jacobs argues that when it comes to thinking, you and I are due for a little, what he calls, filth therapy. There is stuff to be gleaned from that which you and I might think is just refuse. Filth therapy. That health and vitality and beauty might actually be found in that which seems to be anything but. The Native Americans of our country had a saying, and that was, use the whole buffalo. What Benjamin Davies and Alan Jacobs are arguing is that you should use the whole buffalo, including what the buffalo leaves behind. Where's all this going? We're in a series this summer on the parables, because we believe that Jesus means to give us some stories, and there's nobody like Jesus to tell us a story, to tell us what it means to live in between two important waypoints on the larger story, the waypoint between his own resurrection and the resurrection of the dead, and that he tells these stories via parables to tell us what it means to live not just in between those two points, but with respect to them. They're not just sort of facts that we leave in our head. They're something that actually gives shape to the story of our own existence, and we're all in one. And most of the time, it's not the story we would have written for ourselves. Amen? The parable we're going to look at today is a story that to most of those who first heard it, and even to those of us who will hear it today, who might think, why is he telling this story? This is stuff I'd rather leave out. This is a story that would be pretty much, on first glance, be scandalous, filthy. You don't write a book of virtues out of the story that we're going to look at today. You actually leave it out of the table of contents. And Jesus says, don't you dare turn up your nose at this story. Don't you dare. Because while everybody else might want to not give it a second look or to put it to the margins, he's saying there is something here for us in this. So he's not doing so much filth therapy as he's doing a little filth theology. And what he has for us in this parable today, this unlikely story that we're supposed to glean some truth from, is something to do with stewardship. If you're a Christian, there is no such thing as a possession. There is only that which you have been entrusted with. And if you believe that, then you believe that your calling in life is to be a good steward of what has been entrusted to you for as long as it's in your care. And the parable that we're going to look at today speaks both clearly and sometimes implicitly about the nature of stewardship. And I think it has three characteristics of stewardship that we would do well to consider. Stewardship as an act of conservatorship. Don't worry, I'll explain what that means. Stewardship as an act of apprenticeship. And stewardship as an act of worship. It's all three, with the last one being the foundation of the prior two. We're in Luke chapter 16. Would you listen to God with your legs and stand to your feet? Luke 16, starting in verse 1. He also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do? Since my master has taken the management away from me, I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, write 50. And then he said to another, "And how much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill, write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God and money." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. What just happened? He says this, we listen to this, and we think, Jesus is okay with this? What's happening? There's two main characters. Just to recap what you just heard, there's the lord of the estate, and there's his asset manager. Anybody ever watch an episode of Downton Abbey? Oh, Lord, where have you been? Okay, Downton Abbey. There is a character in Downton Abbey named Mr. Carson. He's the butler of the state. And for those of us that were not groomed in an 18th century, or 19th century English pedigree, butlers were not just people that served at table, although that was part of their responsibilities. Far more expansive, butlers were responsible for the staff. They were responsible for the very schedule of the whole family. They were responsible for all of the estate's holdings, all the way from the maintenance of the grounds to the polishing of the silver to the decanting of the 40-year-old port that had been sitting in a cellar for a decade. That's what a butler did. They were far more than servants. They were managers. They were in charge of everything. That's what we're talking about here in the way of this steward.
But as you heard, this steward has been accused by his master of mismanagement. Maybe he's not skimming, maybe he's not thieving, but he is guilty of gross negligence or incompetence such that he's being accused of dishonesty. Although the Greek word there for dishonesty is a word that has a more generic connotation. It's the Greek word adikia. It's very flexible in its meaning. Whatever he was doing it wrongly. So wrongly, the master says to him, "You're done." And the thing is, this manager doesn't dispute the accusation. He doesn't come to defend himself. He knows he's been caught, and there's nothing he can do about it. And so he goes into crisis mode. How am I going to live? And already, you know, he's not a very sympathetic character, right? Like, he's already been accused. He's not disputing the charge. He's already looking into his own future. And then he invites a little bit more disdain because he starts to complain. Like, ain't no way I'm going to dig. Ain't no way I'm going to start asking for alms. It's the part about, like, I'm not going to be caught dead doing either of those things. And anybody in Jesus' day who's listened to this parable is already thinking, Jesus, this guy has made his bed. He's going to sleep in it. And that's where it gets very interesting at this point. Before he serves his last day in the job, he goes to everybody that's indebted to his manager, everybody that's indebted to the Lord of the estate. And he talks about two of them in the parable. One who owes the master oil, one who owes the master grain. And he goes to the first debtor and he says, how much do you owe? First debtor says, I owe him 100 measures of oil. And the manager says, tell you what, call it 50, we'll call it good. Debtor looks at him and says, this is a joke, right? Manager says, nope, this is not a joke. Give me 50, we're good. Manager then goes to the other guy, how much do you owe? I owe the estate 100 measures of wheat. Manager said, let's call it 80, you're all square. Debtor's going, are you kidding me? Manager says, nope, not kidding. And at this point, everybody who's hearing Jesus' story is thinking, this guy's fuse is already lit. And now it sounds like he is dousing himself in preparation for his own self-immolation. Does he realize what he's doing? The manager is going to get less as a consequence of his actions. Why does he think this will help? And that's where Jesus throws in the punchline, or as we like to say, the turnabout in our day, the big reveal, the twist that no one expects. Verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. Commended him. Not he was offended by him or incensed by him, not that he was simply amused by his cleverness. This master finds this servant, this steward, commendable. There's no way of retranslating that word. There's no way in mitigating the approbation the manager is giving this steward. Why is he commending him? He's commending him for his shrewdness. The Greek word there is phronema, talking about his wisdom. Jesus uses that same Greek word a little earlier in the Gospel of Luke to speak of another manager whom he calls wise. Why is he being commended for his shrewdness? This guy is going to be out on his tush tomorrow, and yet the master of the parable is expressing admiration. What for? We know what's behind this manager's actions. He's trying to save his own skin. He's about to be unemployed. And so he says in verse 4, I have decided what to do so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. He is looking for a way to get some street cred so that he might in time be able to make some bread. You know what he's doing? He's thinking about his future, and he wants to do something about it to effect it. And so what does he do? And for as long as people have been considering this parable, people have been wondering what would ever make this manager commend the steward for his actions. He's letting two debtors off easier than what the invoices showed. They're relieved of a sizable portion of their debt. How can the manager do that? It's one of two possibilities that I think work. Two possibilities that make sense to me. The lord of the estate may have been charging these debtors interest. And the manager sort of waltzes in and says to the debtors, guess what? We've decided to go interest-free. Congratulations. We're canceling the interest. And the debtors say, yippee! Interest-free charge! And in that situation, the master of the estate gets his principal, but he can't punish the manager because the manager has just made his lord look really good in the eyes of the debtors and in the eyes of the town. And so he would not dare despise his manager for doing that. The manager has wrested control of the narrative. Word about town, oh, he's being dishonest. Oh, he's being negligent. But now, look what he's doing. He's helping the lord look magnanimous. Yeah, win-win. That's one possibility. The other possibility is this. The manager in that day had the right to charge a commission for any transaction that he might have been responsible for collecting upon, kind of like a broker. Brokers make transactions, brokers get commissions on that transaction. And so what he's canceling possibly might have been whatever commission he would have made on the transaction. We call that today a no-load fee, a no-load transaction. The lord gets what's coming to him. The manager comes off smelling like roses for his apparent generosity to the debtors. Either possibility, whether it's the lord coming off great for canceling the interest or the manager coming off great for canceling the commission, in either case, you know what the lord says to the manager? Well played, steward. Well played. The lord of the estate gets what is his. And the manager ends up looking like the bee's knees for his ingenuity. There is a reason he was introduced as a dishonest manager. He had been negligent in his task. That is true. And the manager is not disputing that. But Jesus is saying to us, don't you dare turn your nose up against him as an example. Because even in his ambiguous character, he has something for everyone who wants to be a disciple. For everyone who wants to be a good steward of what has been entrusted to them in between the times. And that is why Jesus leaves the parable there and in the last half of verse 8 begins to make his point. Verse 8. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. There is something to be gleaned, what we might first think is vile or filthy in terms of morality, and there is something to be gleaned from those who live in this world as if this is as good as it gets. That manager is an example of a lot of people in this world. You know what? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Get what you can for the time that you have, because it's only a matter of time before you're in the ground. Jesus says there is something to be learned from the likes of people like him, oh, people who believe that this is not as good as it gets. In his patent self-interest, there is something for us who are supposed to set aside self-interest. What is it? I've already given you a hint. Let's get into the three things that I think this is an example of what it means to be entrusted with resources. To be a steward is first of all to engage in an act of conservatorship. Now, I know that that is a very modern term applied to a very ancient setting, so bear with me. What Jesus says in verse 9 is intended to remind us of what the manager says in verse 4. Remember in verse 4, he says, I have decided what to do so that people may receive me into their houses. And then in verse 9, Jesus parallels that phrase. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. Jesus is talking about a particular kind of activity that is based upon a particular view of the future. That phrase there, unrighteous wealth, don't get tripped up there. That is, that is not code for blood money, that is not code for dirty money. It's just a turn of phrase, a cultural idiom to speak of the material means of this world that are more often than not tainted or that end up tainting people who go for them. He's not espousing an accrual of wealth by unrighteous means. Jesus is just talking about wealth as that which comes often either from corruption or leads us to corruption. Don't get tripped up there. But how do you make friends with it in that way? Even the ordinary things, even the ordinary wealth, even the stuff that can end up tainting you or comes from tainted hands, how do you make friends with it? You make friends with that kind of wealth by being generous with it. We kind of heard that, something of what the author of Ecclesiastes said during Lent. How do you make friends? You get generous with what you have. Guess what? Scrooge made no friends with his miserliness. It was only when he saw people as more important than his holdings that he began to be generous as a mark of his friendliness toward them. Jesus is talking about generosity as a strategy, as both a premeditated and a spontaneous act. That's what the manager is demonstrating here. But the part about being received into eternal dwellings, what is he getting at there? As you might expect Jesus to talk about, he's talking about the end of all things, where history is headed, about the remaking and the renewal of all things, when it's all going to shake out. Jesus is saying stewardship is always a function of a view of final things. It is always taking the long view in mind. It is always taking into consideration where history is headed, what the stuffy theologians like to call eschatology. Generosity in view of where all in life of history is headed. Now, why am I referring to that as an act of conservatorship? When we brought Jedediah home on a Monday in May in 2010, we were at that moment not, in an official legal sense, his adoptive parents. We were in a probationary period that the state of Texas calls the conservatorship phase. In that phase, according to the law, we were responsible for demonstrating an abiding commitment to his well-being that had a view to his future flourishing. We had to show that we thought it would be a genuine privilege to become his adoptive parents. We weren't his adoptive parents yet. We were his conservators in that moment. Conservatorship is therefore generosity with an eye to the future of the one to whom you're being generous. That's conservatorship. That's what he's manifesting here. Now look, I know that the manager here is talking about his own well-being, his own future flourishing, but he is talking about generosity for the sake of a future. As self-interested as that may sound, Jesus is saying, look at this manager. Even in his self-interest, he is providing for you a parallel in what it means to follow me. That you are to be generous with whatever has been entrusted to you with a view to your future. But let's be really clear about what he is saying and what he is not saying. He is not talking about being generous in order to secure a future. He is talking about being generous as proof of your hope in a future that has been secured for you. If Jesus had just stopped with the parable, we might think he's saying, do what you can, and at the end of your life, we'll see how your ledger is, and then eternal dwellings may or may not be yours. But there's this little thing called the cross. And at that cross, he's meaning to tell us something different, namely that he has come to purchase us a future, and a future that then frees us to be generous with a view to that future. Guess what, brothers and sisters? Stewardship is how you use the material resources at your, not disposal, but in your care. How would you use the resources in your care if you believed that this world was not as good as it gets? If you believed, as one songwriter put it, that you will always have what you gave to love? How would it be different? Jesus is asking you to consider the manager as an invitation to your own reflection, but he has not used the whole buffalo yet. There is more to this parable. There is more to stewardship than an act of conservatorship. There is also this thing called an apprenticeship. What are apprentices? They learn from masters. They're being trained in a skill until they themselves can become teachers. And what Jesus is saying is that there is as much as a skill to stewardship as there is to anything else that's a craft. You have to learn how to care for what's been entrusted to you. And he makes very quick work of what it means to be an apprentice when it comes to stewardship in three ways, entirely uncomplicated. Listen to verse 10 again. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. One who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. You apprentice in what you give your attention to. Because, brothers and sisters, in a sense, we are our habits. What we begin doing on a regular basis becomes a way of doing that may, in time, become utterly unconscious to us. And that is true of both faithfulness and dishonesty. If you keep a good account of where your money goes, you don't come up short at the end of the month in most cases. But if you start learning to steal from people a little at a time, like Bernie Madoff, in a time, you can end up in federal prison with Robert De Niro playing you a film when you don't get a red cent for it. What we do with what we have can foreshadow what you might be called upon to do or what might be done to you in time. Stewardship is an act of apprenticeship. Kids, listen up. There is a big part of you that wants to do what grown-ups do. I get it. You want to stay up late. You want to drive a car. You want to do stuff alone. Maybe you want to jump out of an airplane. Okay, forget about the last part. All sorts of things that you might wish you could do, that your parents do. And the only way I'm saying to you that you're going to show that you're ready to do some of the things that you see mom and dad do is for you to be trustworthy with the stuff that's already your responsibility. If you can be trusted with what's right in front of your face, guess what? You might be in time trusted with more stuff, with more things to do. But only you learn that only by being faithful in what is already in front of you. You are, in that sense, being an apprentice. You are learning in what it means to be a good, faithful person in what you have. Verse 11 is the second part. If you've not been faithful in unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you to true riches? Yes, apprenticing is doing with what is in front of you, but it's also being faithful in what seems utterly trivial, so that in time that you might be responsible for that which is not trivial. Again, the reference there to unrighteous wealth, it's just a way of saying the money, the assets, the things, the little skills you have to do, it is far from being a waste or an unholy practice. Martin Luther said, if you are wiping the behinds of children, you are doing a holy work. How you keep shop at a store, whether you are sweeping up or locking up, how you deal with unkind, unruly neighbors, whether you are turning the other cheek or trying to respond with kindness, how you do your taxes, how you do your scales in piano, how you stay up late in a steamy bathroom with a kid who's got the croup. All of that are contexts in which you are being fitted to be able to manage matters that will not pass like the wind. You are apprenticing in stewardship. The Babylon Bee, you might have heard of it. We've talked about it in the backstory before. It's a Christian satire site. Sometimes it crosses the line, maybe more often than we'd like to admit, but there is one thing that I read recently that's pretty funny. A headline that went like this. Father of three wonders when he'll get a chance to influence others for Jesus. Father of three wonders when he'll get a chance to influence others for Jesus. Brothers and sisters, you listened to me for 4.5 years from this pulpit talk about being faithfully present, of sowing to the kingdom wherever your worlds might be. And I might be the first to concede the truth that those kinds of exhortations, as high sounding as they might come across, might give you the impression that you better head to the street corners and the corridors of power for you to be faithful. Guess what? You might, if you're a parent, just as one example, just need to speak kindly to your kids and ask forgiveness when you don't. I've had 2 weeks of that experience in an RV. It happens. And don't think for a minute that they don't notice it. On Father's Day, when we were around the table and they said, what are one thankful your thing you're thankful for? That daddy knows how to apologize when he's wrong. Hallelujah. I take no credit. All praise to Jesus. Sometimes you just need to set aside time when you want to do something else. It's called being faithful in the so-called mundane, or to use a big SAT word, the quotidian, in order to be faithful in what is critical. Stewardship means apprenticing in that sense also. But thirdly, verse 12, if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Jesus is saying, you're not ready to take possession of anything that you can call your own until you show attentiveness to care for that which belongs to somebody else. When you can respect what is in somebody else's name, can you ever think of being prepared to take responsibility for that which might be in your own name? Real simple. The theology is on the top of the page there. You don't got to plumb its depths. It's just there. Now, all of that moves pretty fast. All that lives over here. So let me put it in a very concrete frame. In that same essay by Alan Jacobs that I raised at the beginning of the sermon, he tells a beautiful story, a beautiful picture of apprenticeship. You may have heard of this. It's a story out of Paraguay. This group is called La Orquesta de Instrumentos Reciclados de Catura. Dave, what did I just say? The Recycled Instrument Orchestra of Catura. You know what Catura is? It's a town built on a landfill. Most kids in that world spend their whole lives picking through trash to survive. But some guy got the idea, what if we did something else? And so he starts to recruit kids to go through the landfill and pick out anything, any serviceable material that might be repurposed, that might be fashioned into musical instruments. And I will put up some pictures on the backstory this week of what they do. These are kids who have turned, who have made cellos out of large oil cans and meat tenderizers. They have taken, they've made violins out of large boxes wrapped in thick plastic, and the bridges are made of forks. They scavenge for anything that can be repurposed and fashioned in instruments. And the director, whose name is Fabio Chavez, says this: the world sends us garbage, we send back music. Here are kids learning to be faithful in trash turned into tunable things. Imagine what it might be someday for them to actually hold finely carved and seasoned wood. They are apprenticing in the small, the mundane, what is essentially borrowed, what is filthy. And in that sense, if the invitation ever comes their way to get on a different stage with a different kind of instrument, they're ready because they've been faithful in whatever they found strewn about their feet. And it's the director who is not only practicing apprenticeship and teaching them to do the same, he's also practicing conservatorship. There's that word again. How is that? Listen to what he says. People realize that we shouldn't throw away trash carelessly. Well, you know what? We shouldn't throw away people either. He is practicing that generosity that has an eye to the future of others. And he's doing more than that. To invite teenagers who would just as soon spend the rest of their life picking through trash just to eat, and instead picking through trash to repurpose it into beauty, that is to ascribe to those children real dignity and worth. And for him to say what I just read to you, him saying, he doesn't just do it because it makes him feel good, even though it does. He is saying that this is something that ought to be done. He's making an evaluative comment. He's making a moral argument there. This is not just something that makes us all feel good. This is something that ought to be done, that it fits with the fabric of all things and the universe. Why am I making that point about apprenticeship? I'll tell you. The evolutionary biologists will tell you that the sort of thing that's going on in Paraguay is just doing what our species has learned to do. That because it was to our advantage to ascribe worth to one another, that that's what we've ended up patterning in. That's just what we do. And while that might be an oversimplification of what evolutionary biologists say, it might even be a debatable point upon which they make. Even if it's true that we may have apprenticed in that practice for a very long time, that not says not a thing about whether we should have. It only says what we might have done. One might feel a desire to do what that director does, but one needs a reason to do that more than just how it makes you feel. And for that, you need something more substantial. And therefore, to practice conservatorship and to practice apprenticeship, you need one more thing that really is the foundation of all stewardship, and that is worship. What you heard in verse 13 might sound very familiar because it's straight out of the Sermon on the Mount. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God in money. Should sound familiar. As we have said many times, you and I might think of ourselves foundationally as people who think. And we think about a lot of things, maybe too much, obsessively, or not at all. But what we really are at our core is those who desire. What you really think, what you really believe, is really borne out by what you really want. And what you really want points to what you really worship. And that's why most recent Nobel Prize winner Bob Dylan said a long time ago on the front of your bulletin, you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. We all submit to someone, whether we know it or not or whether we're willing to admit it. What you believe to be most important is what orients everything you do, and it certainly orients what you do with what you have, how you steward. What will motivate you to act with generosity toward everybody else with a view to the world yet to come? What will motivate you to do that? The worship of the one who is responsible for all that is, and upon whom any hope of a new world ultimately rests. What will motivate you to apprentice in what is the smaller things or the more mundane things or the borrowed things, not only for their own sake, but with a view to the future? What will motivate that? The worship of the one whose first directive to anybody who was alive was to take responsibility to steward what they'd been given. St. Augustine says on the front of your bulletin, famously, he loves thee too little, who loves anything together with thee, which he loves not for thy sake. Wonderfully rhythmic, wonderfully pithy. What in the world does he mean? Here's my take. If your devotion to anything or anyone is not coupled to your devotion to God, then you don't understand it or them, and you surely don't understand God. For to know God as He is to see that all that one has as both from Him and for Him. Brothers and sisters, if there is no God, if there is nothing or no one who governs what ought to be, then you really may do whatever you please with whatever you have. That's just the plain truth of it, okay? But if God is God, then all we have is irreducibly His, and therefore it is on loan to us. It's entrusted to our stewardship. And look, I hear that, and you hear that, and it's possible that there is a shiver going down your spine right now in the sense that you and I have been entrusted with more than we can imagine, and therefore we have a shiver born of fear because we think that maybe in the end our stewardship will be found lacking. I'm afraid of that at times. Brothers and sisters, the worship that underlies this conservatorship and this apprenticeship is not a generic submission to a deity. It's not just serving God because He's big. By virtue of our being made by Him, we've already been entrusted to Him. And the good news of Jesus, the gospel, is that He took His stewardship of those entrusted to Him so seriously that He gave nothing less than His whole self for our good. This table is the ledger of his stewardship. He was the steward above all stewards to make even the most dishonest of stewards able to see everything that they have as that which is to be stewarded. Brothers and sisters, let me close with this. Depending on what commodity we're talking about, we all exist somewhere on a spectrum, some with more, some with less. But there's nobody in this room who just by being alive isn't entrusted with a lot already. If you're alive and listening to me and in the sound of my voice, then you have life, breath, body, time, food, relationships, responsibility, and prayers. The capacity to pray. We're all entrusted. We're all stewards. Which then, in light of this, asks us to ask the question, how is the view of the future we receive from Him fueling your generosity? Is the kind of attention and responsiveness, your faithful presence to what is now before you, how might that be a foreshadowing of what might be yours responsibility later? And most of all, is what's propelling you to be a good conservator and a good apprentice, is what's fueling it worship? A worship that is not out to buy you eternal dwellings, not to buy you into it, but is an act of faithfulness that reveals your hope in eternal dwellings that Christ bought for you. As John Calvin put it on the front of your bulletin, you don't need to turn. He says at the end of that paragraph, the only right mode of administration is that which is regulated by love. And what he means by that is stewardship is not born of the fear of not receiving. It is instead born of the love for Him who moves us to be faithful to what's before us. That's stewardship. And sometimes it is a filthy work. But it covers all of life between the times.